Eavesdropping. It's the title of the memoir by Stephen Cusisto. He's blind, and he says the blind get to eavesdrop on the rest of us, mostly because we don't notice they're listening. And Strainchamp sat down with Cusisto and talked with him about why he wrote a memoir about listening.
It's a funny thing. I was talking to a group of newly blind people in Boston, Massachusetts, and I had just done a pretty good job of talking about going places all over the planet, really, with my first guide dog, whose name was Corky. And suddenly a woman in the back of the room said, "Well, why travel anywhere if you can't see?" She was very depressed. She was probably early 60s, newly blind from diabetes. And I tried to answer the question in that assuring way that all of us who make our living by words often do. You know, I said, "Well, there's great music in Venice and good bratwursts in Milwaukee, and there are all kinds of reasons to travel when you can't see." But I realized I wasn't answering her question, because the question really had to do with neurology, in a sense, the aesthetics that come from having a neurologically wired brain. We all are wired, even the blind, to have pleasure centers in our cortex that are directly connected to the optic nerves. And to imagine rerouting your brain to use an alternative set of senses to replace the beauty of seeing with something else, what would, you know, how would you do that, really? I mean, we talk about it all the time, right? We say, "Oh, the blind must have such better hearing than the sighted. You must be able to hear a mouse 8 miles away," and, you know, all of that stuff, right? We do that all the time. But in point of fact, the blind statistically have no better hearing than anyone else. And if we train ourselves to hear better, what does it mean exactly? And in aesthetic terms, what does it mean?
So one of the themes that's really woven through this book that you wrote is the difference between hearing and listening. And it's also very much your own personal story of learning to, I suppose the way you just described it, kind of connect the pleasure centers in the brain with your sense of hearing. So there's some wonderful stories about the first and most intense memories you have of sound. For instance, some of the earliest scenes are you're in Finland, right, with your parents?
Yeah, the book opens in Helsinki, Finland in 1959, and I'm standing on a dock in the harbor at the end of winter with my father, and he's describing to me his blind child, right? He's describing the different shapes and patterns suggested by ice as it's melting. Old women, even today, will go down to the harbor and beat their carpets. They hang their carpets on racks that stand beside the sea, and they beat their carpets with big whisks, and they sing. And these old women came down to the harbor and began singing old folk songs, you know. And my dad said, "Listen, these are the old songs." And it's one of my earliest memories of these, you know, dour, severe, really essentially ancient sort of archetypal women singing dark folk songs down by the Finnish seashore.
Oi tara, ai tara, lähtä likat laiturille. Oi tara, ai tara, liinat huivit liottamma.
Maybe it was a Saturday. I remember that my parents were still sleeping. I had a plan and dressed quietly. When I was certain that no one was awake, I slipped from the house. I loved to walk in the woods and follow the beams of light or depths of shade that fell between trees. I remember that on this particular day, I got lost while chasing light and found myself standing in front of the university's horse barn. I knew that somewhere in the cool space before me, a horse was breathing. I stood in the door and listened to him breathe. He sounded like water going down a drain. Then I took one step forward into a pyramid of fragrances. Who would guess that horses sometimes hold their breath? The horse was eyeing me from his corner. Then two cats were talking. Wind pushed forcefully at the high roof. Somewhere up high, a timber groaned. My horse was still holding his breath. When would he breathe again? Come on, boy, breathe for me. Where are you? I heard him rub his flank against a wall. Then I heard him breathe again with a great deflation. He sounded like a fat balloon venting in circles. And then I imitated him with my arm pressed to my mouth. I made great flatulent noises by pressing my lips to my forearm. How do you like that, horse? He snorted. I noticed the ringing of silence. An insect traveled between our bursts of forced air. Sunlight warmed my face. I was standing in a wide sunbeam. I was in the luminous whereabouts of horse. Judging by his breathing, his slow release of air, his sound of a concertina, judging by this, I was nearly beside him. And so I reached out, and there was the great wet fruit of his nose, the velvet bone of his enormous face. And we stood there together for a little while, all alive and all alone. At night, when I couldn't sleep, I thought of this horse. I thought of his glory, his fat sound. I thought of how he pinched the air around him with his breathing. The house and the trees swayed in the night wind. The horse was dry wood talking. He was all nerves and nostrils. He tightened and then unwound, like a clock. He groaned, like the Finnish women who stood beside the ocean, waving their sticks, strophe and anti-strophe, step, rhythm, pulse beat. I'd crossed a threshold, hearing and walking, the uncertain space that opened before me.
Kuivatettu, päivä on kuivatettu, pyykit pyöritetty, pyykit on pyöritetty, liinat liotettu, liinat on liotettu, suopa silotettu, suopa on silotettu, vesi valutettu, vesi on valutettu, vesi valutettu, vesi on valutettuna ja liinat on liotettuna.
So we've talked about some of your earliest memories of sound. One of the other kinds of early memories you have are memories of not just the ambient noise of the world around you, but organized sound, music. Those are some especially intense passages. I mean, I have the impression music very early on hit you with just such power.
It's really true. And one dynamic of that continues to be an ongoing fascination for me with the work and career and the old vintage records of Enrico Caruso, the great opera singer.
What do you like so much about Caruso?
Well, one thing is that I discovered Caruso well alone. I wasn't playing baseball. I wasn't part of organized sports. I was free to sort of wander around in the dusty places, right? And one summer, I found myself in my grandmother's great old Victorian house in the attic where there was a wind-up Victrola. And, you know, you're probably familiar with those, that big bell-shaped horn and the big heavy tone arm with the needle in it. And the record was on there, sitting on the platter, as it had been since somebody carted it up to the attic some probably 20 years earlier. This would have been 1960, so it had been up there a while. And, you know, I found out that this thing made spectacular sound, right? That you could wind it up, put the needle in that groove, and there was a recording of Caruso singing from Pagliacci, right? The famous aria Vesti la Giuba, where the clown Canio is lamenting that he has been cuckolded by his wife. And, you know, it's one of the great arias of bel canto opera. And of course, it's an old Victrola record, right? So it's full of scratches and pops and this voice coming out of the horn on a Victrola.
Was
so
it
there
scary,
I was alone in
the
this,
first time you heard.
Oh, fantastically scary. And you know, I mean you just have to picture this, right? It's amazing, discordant, scratchy, groaning noises coming out of this odd bell-shaped device in this attic that's full of pigeons, you know, and I'm up there all alone. And then, of course, because this is a dramatic moment in the opera, Caruso as Canio the clown, who will eventually murder his wife in the opera, right, laughs bitterly, and it comes out of the Victrola's horn like this. Is... I had to run. I fled. I ran from the room, you know.
Stephen, if an operation could give you 20/20 vision tomorrow, would you do it?
You know, it's interesting. In disability culture, people are divided around that kind of question. Some people say that if they could have a medical procedure done and thereby eliminate their disability, they would choose not to do that, that they've grown comfortable with their disabled persona, the disabled self. And more to the point, why should they have to, right? That the disabled self is no less important or valuable or meaningful in the great public tapestry than any other condition or point of origin. So there's a point of pride to disability that you don't have to do that. On the other hand, there are people, and I count myself in this category, who I think probably would, only because, you know, I think I would like to buy a motorcycle and go ripping down a Midwestern road in the middle of summer. There are things I would like to do that I think, you know, the experience of vision would be pretty amazingly about. And so I think I would.
Stephen Cosisto is the author of Eavesdropping, a memoir of blindness and listening. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. And here's Cosisto reading his poem called Elegy for Ray Charles and His Mother. It was written on the day of Ray Charles' death.
Ray, no one knows what it's like to carry water the way your mother made you carry it. Even the boy Pharaoh wore a yoke on his shoulders just to show he was a man. History doesn't matter much, at least until your child done gone blind. You always got to carry water. That's what your mother said. This ain't no kidding around. Long time, you carried water in both hands, feeling for the path with your feet. Ray, your mama knew. A song comes that way, or else it never will. Laugh or cry, it's the same. A mockingbird listens from a telephone wire. Long time. Water. Both hands.
Now don't.